G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2letteru.org. And don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
G'day, Jono.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm getting ready to finish up here and go to bed, and you're getting ready to start your day.
That's right. I'm getting ready to start my day. Not only that, but you are driving the bus this week. You know why?
Why is that?
Because I haven't read it.
Okay. Yeah, but you have an excuse. That's because you're a little, what we would call in Yiddish, fnoodled, because your wife is out of town. She's visiting the land.
She's in the land.
She's in the land.
Yeah. I was speaking to her late last night, in the early hours of the morning, in fact, as I have done for the last few days, in fact, most days while she's been gone. And she's been gone for 2 weeks, Ira, but it's only one more week and she'll be back. And, oh, my goodness. But in the next couple of days, we're going to be talking to her as to what she is doing over there. And the listeners can tune into that. But I've been really, really busy and sort of deprived
of sleep. Awesome. And that's awesome that she's got to go and spend that time there, and you know, she's on that archaeological dig, which is really amazing, and I'm looking forward to hearing. But even more so, what's exciting is that you're going to be going in March, and
true,
and I'm going to be there too.
You'll be there, and I'll be there, and that's in the first couple of weeks of March. You can, dear listeners, if you don't know about it already, if you'd like to meet us and come with us in the land, with Keith Johnson, has set up a tour in the first couple of weeks of March 2013. There is a link on the right-hand side of the website. You'll see the Israeli flag there. The 3T's tour, if you click on that, it'll take you to the details. Be quick, because the bus is filling up.
Amen.
All right. Now, so it's been a learning curve for Chani. She's really been enjoying it. It's also been a learning curve for me, Ira, because I know how to use the toaster now, and that's always fun.
Yeah, and taking care of the kids by yourself.
Yeah, oh, that's
too.
Right. Oh, yeah, I've almost put it. Of course, I'm doing that. So, right. Haven't read.
Of course, I'm doing that.
We've got three, right? One, two, I do.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Job chapter 10. That is where we are. Now, we did leave off with chapter 9, which was in regards to Job kind of role-playing almost a court case with his friends, you know, in defense of himself, because he has, as he complains, he has no mediator. You wanted to pick up on the last few verses of chapter 9 before we get into chapter 10.
Sure. Well, actually, one of the last verses. Because I think what we're starting to see is we're going to see a radical shift in this chapter. And this shift was kind of set up in the last chapter, in the last verses, when we saw in chapter 9, verse 33, where it says, Lo yesh b'neinu mochiach yashet yado al shenenu. No mediator is between us that will put his hand on the two of us. You know, we kind of touched on it. We didn't really go into detail about it. And of course, this is, this is one of those passages that people can think what they want about, and they kind of build up scenarios about it and build up doctrines about it and everything else. But the truth of the matter is, it says what it says. It's related to this book. It's related to Job. And we're going to see that word that I said, mochiach. We're going to see this a couple of other times in the study when we go through some other chapters.
Mochiach is mediator.
Mediator. Yeah. Okay. It's the word for mediator. And we're going to see this word or a form of it several more times in our study of the book of Job. And what the root of this is the word to reprove or rebuke. But in other verb forms, it can actually mean to argue, and to argue as it relates to a lawsuit, to be found to be right, meaning that you're vindicated based on a lawsuit, to make a defense, to convict, to avenge, and then finally to mediate. And so this is where this idea of the mediation comes in, and I thought it would be interesting for people to understand that, that this is what it's talking about, that this really sets the tone for what we've been saying for the last few chapters about this really being starting out with a divine council, where it's actually a courtroom setting where God meets with HaSatan and the B'nei HaElohim, the Malachim, the angels of God, and they have this divine council. And now we're seeing a council that's going on earth as well. So there's a courtroom drama going on in the heavenlies as we start, and now we have this courtroom drama going on earth now. And so what we're starting to see is another shift. that we actually have already seen earlier in the study. And the first time we saw this was in chapter 7, because partway through the chapter, Job changed the subject of his speech. In other words, he was answering his friends at first, mm-hmm. and then he begins to speak to God. And we saw that in Job chapter 7, verse 11, yep. where he says, "On my part, I will not speak with restraint. I will give voice to the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." And that's when he begins to speak directly to God. And then here we come into chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we begin to...
And chapter 10 is solely directed to God, if I'm correct. So it begins like this, and I think we mentioned this poor lion last week, and we left it there. But it begins like this. It says, "My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked?" Now, is he referring to his friends? Smile on the counsel of the wicked?
Well, you know, he could be there. And I think he gets more into that in the next chapter. We see more of that. Well, we'll see this, and then we'll see that when Zophar, in chapter 11, answers him, it would appear that in a certain way he is, mm-hmm. you know, referring to them. So we saw this. We saw similar language to this, you know, earlier in the chapter as well. Earlier in the study as well, in Job chapter 9, verse 27 and 28, he says, "If I say I will forget my complaint, that I will leave behind or abandon my sad face and smile, I am afraid of all my pains. I know that you will not acquit me." And we mentioned last week that he'd like to forget his complaint against God and put on a bold smile despite his circumstances, but he can't because his pains don't stop. And why? He says, because God doesn't relent from terrorizing me. And then we see in Job chapter 10, verse 2, it says, "I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you quarrel with me." Mm-hmm. Okay. And we see in last week's chapter, verse 20 actually says, "If I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. If I am blameless, Tom, he will declare me perverse." And what we see there is something interesting. In 10:2, we see this. Tarshieni and Tirveni, and then in chapter 9, verse 20, we see the Hebrew Yarshieni, and both of them come from the root Rasha, which is wicked.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Hefil that we find here, it's to declare guilty, and so there's that legal language again. And
sure.
And when we see that word where I said we saw Tirveni, okay, in chapter 10, verse 2, that is also from the root reshud bet, which is to strive or contend, the way we see it in English, but it's striving or contending to decide or try a legal case. So now, based on what we know of the Hebrew and the legal terms used, he's basically saying, "I will say to God, do not declare me guilty. Let me know upon what you are deciding my case."
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how can you declare me guilty without first letting me know what the charges are?
Sure.
In other words, you've already punished me. You've already sentenced me. You know, you've declared me guilty. I haven't even had a trial yet. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what I'm charged with.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is where, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say again, that just repeating that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked. In verse 3, it reminded me of another verse that I just found, and it's in Habakkuk. Let me see. It is chapter 1, verse 13. "You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he?"
Right.
And this is so often the question, isn't it, in various forms, that people, it really, when it boils down to it, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah, but he's starting to
good
on.
Things and good things happen to bad people.
Sure, but See. He's really starting to come on really strong here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, he's starting to come on really strong with his words. A good literal translation for me of the Hebrew here would be, "Is it good for you to defraud that you reject the labor of your hands and shine upon the counsel of the evil?" In other words, you know, you're rejecting the fact that you made me. You know, it's and we see a similar word. That word there is ta'ashok in verse 3, and we see this. I have three verses to give you an idea of how this is used. One is Leviticus 5, verse 21. Actually, I have more than three verses. It says, when a person sins and commits a trespass against Yehovah by dealing deceitfully with his fellow in the matter of a deposit or a pledge or through robbery or by defrauding his fellow, he's actually charging God with defrauding him. In verse 19, chapter 19, verse 13 of Leviticus, it says, you shall not defraud your fellow. You shall not commit robbery. The wages of the laborer shall not remain with you until morning. In Deuteronomy 24, 14, you shall not defraud a needy and destitute laborer, whether a fellow countryman or a stranger in one of the communities of your land. And then in Isaiah 52, 4, it says, for thus says Yehovah your God, of old my people went down to Egypt to sojourn there, but Assyria has defrauded them, giving nothing in return. And so that's a pretty strong word to use.
Well, it is, but you know what? I mean, is it, the question has to be asked, is it fair? Because when you think about it, we've established, I mean, it's obvious, Yehovah has given permission that these things happen to Job.
Right.
Therefore, Yehovah is responsible for taking these things away from him, a man who he declares to be righteous, upright, and blameless. Therefore, is it fair that Job says to God that he has robbed him of his possessions and his family and his health?
Well, I'm going to hold off on answering that until we get into some of the other verses.
Okay.
Because I think we start to see an answer, potentially, you know, one of a different perspective that maybe will answer for us what the issue was really with Job.
And so he starts firing questions. I mean, the first one, obviously, you know, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked. Mm-hmm. Do you have eyes of flesh? Or do you see as man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you know that I am not wicked and there is no one who can deliver from your hand.
Mm-hmm. So he asks him, do you have eyes of flesh? He's basically asking God if he sees him the same way that his friends see him. Okay. And then in verse 5, or he's like the days of a human being, your days like that of man. And in verse 7, when he says, you know that I am not guilty and there is none to deliver me from your hand, we saw something similar again back in chapter 7, which is where, again, he was speaking to God. And he said, had I sinned, what have I done to you, watcher of man? Why did you make me your target that I become a burden to myself? And so it seems that there are two accusations going on here. I mean, a few chapters ago, Job was making God so lofty. Remember, we talked about this, that he was making God so lofty that he was incapable of understanding humankind. You know, he said he's up in this, you know, up on a lofty heights and everything else, and does he even, you know, think about man? And now he's asking God, no man can deliver from your hand, and yet you are going to lower yourself to my level. And it almost seems like Job is accusing God of trying to goad him into some type of sin of blasphemy. And some people might see that. You know, some people might say, just like you said, look, he did take these things away. He said, you know, have you not considered my servant Job, you know, who's both blameless and upright? So some people might say that, you know, what's the point? Why is God doing this to him?
I think it's a fair question to consider. It goes on to say, your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity. An intricate unity is what I've got in verse 8. Yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay, and you turn me into dust again? How about that? Remember, I pray, that you made me like clay, and yet you would turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Clothe me with skin and flesh, knit me together with bones and sinews, and you have granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. Now this,
sure. So I need to ask you. In verse 8, you said that, you know, something about unity there. That the translation for you was about unity.
What is that? An intricate unity is what I've got.
An intricate unity. That sounds what version are you reading?
This is the New King James. This is the New King James.
Ah, the New King James. So they might have a little bit of a slant on that word yachad, I think, is where they're getting that from.
Which is unity, okay.
Because it says yadecha, Yadecha itzvuni vayasuni yachad saviv vat valeni. That yachad, so I'm assuming that's what they're saying. That word, the first word that we see, yadecha itzvuni, your hand shaped me, talking about bound me up. It's almost like bound him up. And that word yachad there actually is not what you think it is. I mean, of course, it relates to the idea of, you know, this oneness or unity, but that's not what it means in the context of this verse. Because the verb form is actually related to the idea of to single out or to designate. And what it can also mean, it can mean to unite in the sense as, like we talk about as a husband and wife becoming one flesh. And he goes back to the thought that he actually expressed in verse 3, where he says, how is it that you despise the creation of your own hands?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I know that you don't want me to go there, but he's been sitting there for some time with the worms eating at his flesh. And the next verse, I think, sheds some light on what he's saying. Because in verse 9, he says, remember now that like clay you made me, and to dust I will return. So he's basically saying, look, he knows that God is the God of creation. And he knows that he was made of clay and was meant to return to dust because mm-hmm. he obviously knows the nature of God. And so kind of to oversimplify here, he says, I know I'm only a mere mortal, but this seems like an entire waste of time. This whole suffering thing, it just seems like a waste of time. Like in the in the greater realm of you being God, what does it achieve that you've lowered yourself to my level?
Now listen, can I just say something there? Is it not? And I think we might have mentioned this before, but it's worth highlighting again that it makes perfect sense that Job would be wallowing in his pain and suffering, wondering. Surely God has got greater things to do than to make me suffer like this for no apparent reason. What on earth can it possibly achieve? What can this achieve in the greater scheme of things? I don't understand. And it's entirely fair for him, I would say, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I think it's fair for him to think that in the realm of his sphere of understanding that he has. And yet here we are, potentially, I don't know, 4,000 years later, reading about it and learning from it, and for so many centuries, people have been reading and learning from the Book of Job, and he's the whole story has served as an incredible example of teaching. But let me just go back to that second line of verse 8, because I think I missed the point. An intricate unity. How would you interpret that?
Your hand shaped me and bound me up and made me all together. Okay.
Uh-huh. I'm with you.
So all together you devoured me, or all at once you devoured me.
Sure.
It's the idea of designating this punishment, this suffering, or singling him out.
Mm-hmm.
As it relates to that, it's not the idea of this whatever that reference to the intricate unity that nobody can ever understand because it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. You have granted me life and favor, and you and your care has preserved my spirit. And yet, these things you have hidden in your heart, I know. Okay, so what things? These are obviously the things, the reasons, or justification as to what's happening. I suppose seem hidden in God's heart. He's not sharing them with Job. Job's there without understanding. He goes, I know that this was with you. If I sin, then you mark me and will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am wicked, woe to me. Even if I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I am full of disgrace. See my misery. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. And again, you show yourself awesome against me. You renew your witness against me and increase your indignation towards me. Changes and war are ever with me.
Wow, that's a lot of verses.
Yeah, I'm pretty quick.
I know you're quick. So going back a little bit, so we know that in verse 10, it started with this idea of a dissertation on conception and the formation of man. So when we see that idea of, you poured me out like milk and congealed me, You know, like cheese, that's really talking about his birth. It's talking about conception. You know, there's actually a really interesting reference to it in a Deuterocanonical book, The Wisdom of Solomon, in chapter 7, verse 2. It says, "And in my mother's womb was fashioned to be flesh in a time of 10 months being compacted in blood." It's that same idea of congealing there. And so he sets up this whole thing where he's clothed with skin and flesh, with bone and sinew. And he talks about naked. I came from. I wanted to do that really. I wanted to talk about that really quick because in chapter 1, verse 21, we see this idea. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked will I return there. Jehovah gave, and Jehovah has taken away. May the name of Jehovah be blessed." Mm-hmm. And it may be sound a little bit strange to us today. Because he's saying one day he'll return to his mother's womb. But at the time, the practice was for an extended family to all be buried together in a single tomb that was used over and over again. Mm. You know, and after the body had decomposed, in about a year, the bones were then placed in a receptacle in the tomb that held all the bones of the deceased family members. And this is really the source of the biblical expression, to be gathered to the Father. So in a sense, it was true that at death he would return to his mother's womb. So I just wanted to, you know, to talk about that real quick as it relates to this idea of conception.
So also in regards to that, I mean, let me just really quickly read this other verse because since I started reading this, it's been playing on my mind, and I know it's so familiar to everybody else, and that's Psalm 139. From verse 13, "For you have formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth, and your eyes saw my substance, being yet unformed, and in your book they are all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them."
Right. Amen. Man, I had that verse, but you've been running ahead, so I'm trying to trying to catch up to you.
I'm trying to justify my existence here because I haven't read it yet.
I gotcha. So, I mean, you know, in verse 12, we see this idea of life and loving kindness you created with me, and your oversight or your supervision guarded my spirit. So he's saying you took this much care in my conception, you know, my formation and my oversight for the time in my mother's womb, and yet here we are. Here I am sitting here. And these things in verse 13, "and these things you have hidden in your heart, I know this was with you. I know that you had this in mind." He's almost accusing God and saying, like, you know, you were planning this all along, God. You know, in verse 14, "if I sin, you watch me, and from my iniquity, you would not purify me." We see this same kind of thing in chapter 9, verse 28, when he says, "I fear all my sorrow. I know that you will not purify me." And actually, literally, in chapter 10, verse 14, it would say, instead of "you would not purify me," it would say, "you will not leave me unpunished," would be a better way of translating. In other words, you only created me so that you could watch for my sin and then punish me. Like, you are watching every little thing that I do. You will not look away from me until you find some type of sin in me, is what he's saying. "If I'm wicked, woe to me. And if I'm just or righteous, I cannot lift my head. I'm overflowing with shame and seeing my affliction." And so this is the verse that I wanted to wait till to answer your question that you asked. Mm-hmm. Because again, we have this instance where Job remarks on the futility of his situation. And he considers that with God, he's in a kind of a lose-lose situation. There's no winning with God. You know, it's the same thing, whether you're righteous or wicked, you're going to get the same punishment. And so understanding, which we know that Job is a difficult book to understand, and that we've tried to bring light to some obscure Hebrew and obscure passages, we have no choice but to present all the different perspectives or possibilities. And so we kind of make it clear that we're not hanging our hat on any particular thing, you know. You know, look, I could probably take out 10 commentaries on Job, and, you know, each one might have some very similar things, and then they're all going to have different interpretations on some of the obscure Hebrew. And so for me, this could be one of the most significant verses from one perspective. And this is based on that word shame, okay? Based on that word shame, where he says, I'm overflowing with shame and seeing my own affliction. And the reason I say that is because, to a certain extent, one could make the argument based on this verse that Job, in his affliction, is taking a worldly rather than a spiritual view of his situation, and that he seems to be more concerned with the disgrace and the shame that he's being subjected to by those around him, by his friends and all the people that see him, who knew him once as kind of an elder in the gate, as this great man of the East with great wisdom, with great wealth and everything else. And he seems to be more concerned with that rather than seeing the big picture and kind of eternal ramifications, which is interesting in light of his use of the birth and death themes throughout his defense. Because we see that all the time. We see this life and death thing, and yet it, with this idea of him being overflowing with shame, who is he shamed in front of? He's not shamed in front of God. He doesn't know what God's thoughts are. He doesn't know why this is happening. He just knows that, you know, his situation, his present situation now is that people are looking at him and we can only imagine, you know, what people are saying about him. And this idea of not lifting his head, you know, that we're gonna see soon, actually speaks to that subject, because it could potentially have this idea of that because of his affliction and so forth, he's unable to look up, and it's almost like he's not able to look these guys in the eye, so to speak, like looking at somebody face to face or looking at them in the eye.
Sure, and indeed, I mean, it could be literal too. I mean, it could be that he's just so weak that he can't lift himself.
No, that's true. That's very true. I'm just saying, you know, from another perspective, you could see that, because he goes on to say, is it something to be proud of to hunt me like a lion, to show yourself wondrous through me time and time again, in verse 16. And this is one of those really difficult ones to translate, but I actually like this. This was the one from JPS. Here's what Rashi says. I like this translation too. It says, it became too much that you set traps for me as for a lion, so you returned again and again to render punctilious judgment against me.
Wait, what does that mean?
I like that word, punctilious.
Explain that one for me. That's a new word.
So what it's saying is that you return again and again, bringing strict or exact judgment against me. And really, this verse actually seems to confirm, or this rendition actually seems to confirm what we brought earlier in verse 6 and 7, where it says that you seek my iniquity and my sin you search for. You know that I am not guilty, and there is none to deliver me from your hand. And then in back in chapter 7, verse 20, he said, had I sinned, what have I done to you, watcher of man? Why did you make me your target that I have become a burden to myself? And so to break it down, Job is basically saying, like traps that you set for a lion, you know, in a sense, exposing me to this type of agony is a trap set for me to sin. But I'm standing firm, and I've refused to enter into blasphemy. So he's basically saying, you've tried, you're tired of the test now, God, and now you expose my every action to the exacting and finicky judgment. But I think that in the context of what we're seeing, he's really in this mode of deep accusation of God at this point. And I think the reason is because, look, we really don't know how long this has been going on. You know, we do know that he was sitting there for 7 days in silence with his friends. And we do know that two people have already spoken. And so we don't know how long a process this has been. And you can only imagine the agony that this guy is in. You can only imagine that to a certain extent, a lot of what he's saying now, in his defense now, that's why I'm saying we bring all these different perspectives. In his defense, you got to think that the guy was crazed with agony, with pain and frustration. And that, you know, he was just saying things out of this out of his affliction, and not necessarily, you know, because I want to defend the guy a little bit too here, you know, not seem like I'm getting so down on Job. But he does bring some strong accusations. I mean, look, in verse 17, what does your version say in verse 17?
In 17 it says, you renew your witness against me. Uh-huh. And increase your indignation towards me. Changes and war are ever with me.
Right. And so I put down a couple, because the typical English translations are similar to what you read. You renew your witness against me and increase your anger toward me. And the KJV says changes and war are against me. In the NAS, it says hardship after hardship is with me. In the NIV, it says, your forces come against me wave upon wave. And then I have, you renew your witness against me and you increase your anger with me. Your army exchanges with me. Okay. Hmm. What's really interesting about that, and the reason why I'm bringing that translation is because what it says is, Tichadesh Edecha, you know, you renew Tichadesh, like Chadash, you renew your witness against me. V'terev ka'ascha imadi chalifot v'tzava imi. And that word tzava is the same word for we get tzivaot. Okay?
Ah, right. Okay.
And tzava there is talking about war. So when you read something like changes in war against me, that's why you see that word war there, because it's from v'tzava. Okay, but what it's talking about there, when you have the context of Tichadesh Edecha, your witness, it actually could be your witnesses are against me, mm-hmm. or you renew your witnesses against me, and you increase your anger, your army exchanges with me, and the word is actually that word for host, as in the heavenly host. So I'm not even sure that Job realizes what he's saying. And it's really quite ironic when you think about it, because we start off with that divine council that we talk about that includes the host of heaven. And this is who he claims that Yehovah is using against him, in a sense. And, and from another perspective, Job is saying that his unspeakable experiences, unspeakable, of course, my friends, because Jonah doesn't like me describing his suffering.
Poor Job.
Poor Job.
Come on, it's so gruesome. That's we revisit it every single time, the poor guy.
Only because I know how much it bothers you.
Oh, it's so squeamish. Yeah.
So he's saying that these unspeakable experiences, that they are witnesses against him. Like it could go either way. It could be that he's saying, look, you know, the heavenly host is against me, or he could be saying that they are witnesses against me, these experiences, testifying to God's ability to make me squirm with no let up, with no time to swallow. And all that is left to him is this constant exchange of one suffering for another. So that would be another way that we could possibly translate the verse as well. Remember, we have these verses that are just like, you know, even the great sages in Judaism, you know, you know, the typical thing, you ask two Jews or two sages and you get three or four opinions. So,
yeah, sure.
You know, it's difficult.
Well, in any case, it certainly makes me squirm. But in at the end of chapter 10, 18 to 22, we kind of revisit chapter 3. It says, right. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I had perished and no one had seen me. So he'd rather have gone from the womb to the tomb, really, is what he's saying.
Basically, and you know what? And that's a good translation, actually.
Yeah, really. And he elaborates on that very point. I would have been as though I had not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. And are not my days few? Cease, leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort before I go to the place from which I shall not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, and a land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death, without any order, where even the light is like darkness. And there's an incredible emphasis on dark and shadow and darkness.
Sure, and that's interesting that he's bringing that now, because we saw him talk completely differently in some of the previous chapters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in verse 18, why did you cause me to come out of the womb? Would that I had died and no eye had seen me. We've seen him talk like this before. Mm-hmm. You know, had I been as though I never was, carried from belly to grave or womb to tomb, as you said, in chapter 3, verse 10 and 11, for it did not come, for it did my mother's womb and hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die from the womb, come out of the belly and expire? He talked about this already.
Mm.
So we have to believe at this point that it is the agony of his condition, like I said before, that's driven him to this type of language. And this language can really be considered bordering on blasphemy, depending on how you read it. Why? Because in chapter 13, the same Job who was calling God an ogre, who has no compassion in his response to Zophar that we're going to see in chapter 13, he then starts to speak of God in these soaring and sublime, you know, adorations. Mm-hmm. So you got to believe that lot of what he's saying is fueled by his situation.
Do you think he's actually, I mean, you say that Job is calling God an ogre. I mean, do you think he actually is, or do you think he's saying, how else am I to interpret this? It seems like you're being like this, and yet I know that you're not unjust, and yet how am I to understand it? Because you're not talking to me. You're not giving me any reason. All I'm left with is my reasoning that tells me that you're wrong, but I know you're not wrong.
Right, which is why I believe that it has to be fueled by this way, because all of us are like this. You sure. know, it's human nature to be in a situation that, look, it's very easy to adore God and to love God and to, you know, to come out with these sublime, things that we say about Yehovah all the time. But, mm-hmm. you know, put somebody in trouble and one or two things happen. The first thing that happens is we trust God and we believe God, and then maybe things don't change. And so little by little, the faith starts to wane, and then people will start to question their faith, and people will start to shake their fist at God. And I don't think there's really anything wrong with that. I think that if we're going to look at Yehovah as a loving father, not as typically the way some people want to look at him, as this just exacting God, in some ways that Job is describing him, that some people still have, you know, a picture of, mm-hmm. that if we see him as a loving father, then look, we've not yelled at our own earthly fathers. We've not contended with them. You know, I certainly have, when my father was still alive. So I see this same kind of thing here. And that's why I make the argument that he's kind of going in and out of this. Mm. In verse 20, are not my days few? Refrain from setting upon me. It actually would say here, again, there's a word at the end there that we see, v'avliga, which is one of those obscure words again. And it can mean, let me have a glimmer or a flash. It's almost like, can I even get like a break, a glimmer of hope, a flash of light, something? Back to chapter 7 again, in verse 15 and 16, he says, and my soul chooses strangling death rather than these old bones of mine. I despise it. I don't want to live forever. Leave me alone, he says to God, for my days are breath. Mm. And the difference is that prior to this, Job saw, and this is why I said this is interesting that we're seeing in these last couple of verses, especially that idea of darkness and gloom that he talks about, is that prior to this, Job saw the grave as a place of peace. Mm. Remember that? He said, yeah. Let me die so I can be in peace. Mm. You know, in chapter 3, he wishes that he would never have been born so that he could go to the ideal resting place he talks about. But now it seems that he wants to live, in a sense, and that God would just relent for a short time and give him some peace in whatever days he has left on the earth. It's like it kind of reminded me when I was looking at this, you know, the whole idea of everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the whole idea that we talked about, you know, just a minute ago, that, you know, when things are going well in life, we have one perspective about death and the grave. And then when we're going through intense testing, we have a completely different perspective on death and the grave. And I think that this is what's happening. In verse 21, before I go and do not return to the earth, darkness, and this is interesting, it says choshech v'tzal mavet, okay? Mm-hmm. And what that, because we see this idea of choshech, which we know is darkness, but this word v'tzal mavet is talking about an impenetrable gloom. That it's not just darkness, but it's almost like, I got to imagine, almost like that darkness that came upon Mitzrayim during the plagues, where, you know, it was almost like you could feel the darkness. It has this idea of being pitch black, not just darkness, but a darkness that's impenetrable that you can actually feel. And then finally, a land of darkness, as darkness itself and of the shadow of death without any order, and where light is as darkness. Mm. And so we kind of see that now that Job wants to live, you know, at least it sounds like now, that the grave takes on this threatening dimension of darkness and gloom instead of that beautiful resting place that he thought about. And what's interesting in this, in one of these last verses, is that we actually see a Kri Kativ. And a Kri Kativ meaning that when you look at the codex, for instance, or you look at the BHS, what you'll see is that in verse 20, We have this creative that goes on that starts in verse 20, where it appears that the context changes and that he is no longer, in a sense, that he's no longer saying this directly toward God, but kind of only thinking about it in his mind now. And this is kind of typical with someone who is suffering. And it's this reason that it would appear that Job kind of now realizes all of the accusations that he's hurled at God. I think he starts to realize this, and he kind of takes a step back, and he realizes that he's let his suffering and agony goad him into this. And what we would appear to have here is basically a good and blameless man that is crazed by pain and frustration, which I said earlier. That's what I believe. And it would seem that that the excess that he allowed himself to got caught up in is where our next friend comes in and takes up where Bildad left off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get into chapter 11 and we see, you know, what I consider the most antagonistic of the friends, the least compassionate, and the most arrogant is Job's buddy Zophar,
mm-hmm.
that we see in chapter 11.
Chapter 11. But before we talk about chapter 11, actually, you know what? We might not talk about chapter 11. I think
okay.
we'll leave that.
All right.
We might leave that until next week. But
okay.
just the last final verses here of chapter 10. If I just turn over to Psalm 88, and I'm thinking I may even just read the whole thing, and this is a psalm of the sons of Korah, mm-hmm. would it be out of place for me to read this? Because it kind of emphasizes the point of the last three verses, at least some of the concepts there.
Sure.
It says, "O Yehovah, God of my salvation, I have cried out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of troubles and my life draws near to the grave. I am counted with those who go down to the pit. I am like a man who has no strength, adrift among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and who are cut off from your hand. You have laid me in the lowest pit, in darkness, in the depths. Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you have afflicted me all with all your waves. You have put away my acquaintances far from me. You have made me like an abomination to them. I am shut up, and I cannot get out. My eyes waste away because of affliction. Yehovah, I call to you. I call daily upon you. I have stretched out my hand to you. Will you work wonders for the dead? Shall the dead arise and praise you? Selah. Shall your loving kindness be declared in the grave, or your faithfulness in the place of destruction? Shall your wonders be known in the dark, and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? But to you I have cried out, O Yehovah, and in the morning my prayer comes before you. Yehovah, why do you cast off my soul? Why do you hide your face from me? I've been afflicted and ready to die from my youth. I suffer your terrors. I suffer your terrors. How about that? I am distraught. Your fierce wrath has gone over me. Your terrors have cut me off. They came around me all day long like water. They engulfed me altogether. Loved one and friend, you have put far from me and my acquaintances into darkness. There's certainly a again the theme of darkness and the grave and Sheol and suffering and realizing that it is Yehovah who has done this, and it's again a plea to him.
Amen. So I think we have
Wait,
a visitor.
Who's that?
Hey, shalom, guys. This is Nehemia Gordon, the wandering Jew in Florida.
Nehemia Gordon?
Treasures from the Tanakh has been hacked by Nehemia Gordon.
What is Nehemia Gordon doing on Treasures from the Tanakh?
What do you mean? I'm in the next room. I'm at Ira's house. I'm the wandering Jew, homeless.
This is my show. Go back
People,
to Torah Pearl.
Turn off the recording. Stop playing. Stop and go over to Torah Pearls, the best show on Truth to You. Torah Pearls with Joni Vendor and Keith Johnson and Nehemia Gordon. Torah Pearls on Truth to You.
Have you got your Tanakh in front of you?
I could pull it up. I am the caffeinated Karaite.
The man is out of control, folks.
We're closing down from Job chapter 10.
Just wrapping it up.
Yeah, okay. I'm just wrapping it up, but I just read a...
And I'm just wrapping it up here in Florida. I'm about to head over to Israel with Keith Johnson, where we're going to go down, hopefully if the military situation allows us to, we're going to go down to the Eilat Mountains, where we're going to sight the new moon, and people can support that by going to nehemiahswall.com.
Nehemiahswall.com, yes.
That's the second commercial for the new moon mission to Israel.
NehemiahsWolf.com. Listen, don't get shot. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm trying not to get shot, but I'm
You're not using Keith as you're using Keith as a human shield, right? That's why you're taking him.
Well, I think he's using me as the human shield. At night, who's going to stand out more, the light skinned heavy guy or this little you know?
That's a good point. But you be careful. You be careful, bro.
Yeah.
Job chapter 10. Have you got any pearls of wisdom from Job chapter 10 before we say goodbye?
No. I got nothing.
You got nothing.
Wait a minute. This is a first, folks.
Look, I didn't
don't edit this out, please. leave this in here. Nehemia Gordon has nothing to say.
There it is.
Verse 21. Before I go, and I shall not return. Goodbye, folks.
To the land of darkness and the shadowy death. Well, I hope that doesn't happen when they go to Israel. No. I'm sure they'll be fine.
He's gone. He left us. Yeah. That should be really interesting. He's getting ready to leave, you know, here in a couple of weeks and go over and do that. And then he's going to be starting a tour and traveling out to the Pacific Northwest and then back to the East Coast, you know, doing up north. And
so he'll be back in the States. So we should just remind everybody that he's going to be in the States and also yourself and Keith for a number of months. So if there are congregations, fellowships that would like to set up a meeting, a seminar, a talk with Nehemia Gordon, and it's a great time to do it because he's just released his new book, Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence, which is also available from nehemiasworld.com, then you can contact him through that website. There's a contact page there. Certainly send him an email and set up a date.
Amen.
Sounds good. We're going to leave it there, my friend. I've got to go and make breakfast and make sure the kids aren't destroying the house.
There you go. I'm going to go eat some dinner.
You go and do that. We've been speaking to Ira Michelson, Torah teacher, my friend. Thank you for coming back on and driving the bus in Job chapter 10. I promise next week I'll have read it and made some notes in advance.
Good.
But until then...
We're going to need to put the pedal to the metal and start driving the bus a little faster.
Because, so next week, as you mentioned, Zophar, his mate sort of weighs in and we're going to see what he has to say. Until then, dear listener, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.